Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Morocco's earthquake death toll rises to more than 2,800.
The new update of today, it's that the earthquake death toll, 2,681 persons.
Zimbabwe's president announces his new cabinet following the August 23 election. A Zimbabwe human rights activist demands an end to alleged abduction. Tanzanian police question and release an opposition politician over plans to support the Maasai ethnic group. Malawi's president takes steps towards eliminating food shortages.
Most of our forex revenue comes from farming. But given the forex challenges we have faced in the recent past, it is clear that our long-term solution has to involve boosting agricultural productivity for exports.
And the U.S. pauses to mark the 22nd anniversary of 9/11 terror attacks. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Late reports on Monday say Morocco's 6.8 magnitude earthquake death toll has reached more than 2,800 people confirmed dead. According to Reuters, the quake also damaged one of Morocco's most important historical sites. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department said that the Moroccan government has not responded to United States' offer to provide support in earthquake relief. For the latest, I spoke with freelance journalist Emmanuel Victor Ngapila in Marrakech.
The new update of today, it's that the earthquake death toll, 2,681 persons. And the number of injured reached 2,501 persons.
What can you tell us, Emmanuel, about the extent of the destruction so far, apart from residential areas? Now, we are getting reports of some historical sites that have been also damaged. What can you tell us?
Many buildings were damaged, several hundred homes. Of course, also at least 530 schools, according to the Moroccan Ministry of Education. Among the building damage were some the oldest religious building in the region. Building in the Jewish quarter of Marrakech, estimated to be over 400 years old, and many other historic buildings, both in the city of Marrakech and in the surrounding village.
When we spoke the last time, you indicated that the people needed tents. What can you tell us about humanitarian assistance now? Are the people getting tents? Because we hear countries are coming to the rescue. What do you know?
Has been stepped up size yesterday, and the people affected are receiving care and aid, including tents and other survival equipment. But this is still not enough. By example, at Ouarzazate, while efforts are being concentrated on the Al Aouz region, the epicenter of the earthquake, Ouarzazate local and voicing their dissatisfaction with the current distribution of aid resources. Affected villages across Morocco have been receiving vital humanitarian assistance, including food, supply, blankets, tents, and other essential items. This effort has been initiated by the order of the King Mohammed VI.
What can you tell us about hospitals? How are the people, the wounded, being treated?
One of the main things we have noticed is that as soon as the earthquake struck, the health authorities set up an emergency plan to quickly treat those injured in the regent hospital, while those with more serious injuries were taken directly to Marrakech main hospital. It should also be noted that private clinics have also been made available to treat the injured people.
Emmanuel Victor Ngapila is a freelance journalist. He was speaking with us from Marrakech, Morocco. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa has announced his new cabinet following the country's August 23 elections. The cabinet includes his son as deputy finance minister, as well as the president's nephew as minister of tourism. Critics say the new cabinet mirrors the old one and has little capacity to deal with some of the major economic issues confronting Zimbabwe. Vince Musewe is a Zimbabwean economist. He tells me that the level of competence reflected in the new cabinet is disappointing.
Well, it's pretty disappointing. Number one, you know, there's not really fresh brains in that cabinet. It's, old people who have been brought in, particularly the key industries that drive this economy, mining, agriculture and energy, and also tourism and infrastructure. Either them or people, or very young people who really don't have an experience. So all in all, we're pretty disappointed at the level of competence that is reflected in the cabinet.
Did you see any member of the opposition, or did the president reach out?
No, there isn't at all. I mean, he actually stated that he doesn't have to. He doesn't have to bring in any opposition. You see, the issue is in that system, regardless of where you come from, are you able to play the competence you have? So it would be very difficult, for example, someone who's quite competent has got a different value system to operate in that system and be effective. So this appointment of opposition is actually, at the end of the day, becomes a meaningless exercise.
I noticed a couple of women on the list of the new cabinet. What do you think?
Well, there isn't anyone there who raises eyebrows as very sharp and competent. He's, for example, given the Minister of Industry to a 74-year-old woman who hasn't been really effective since she was previously a Minister of SMEs and Women Affairs. So, even though we might have a few women there, but to balance gender equity, the issue is really about lack of competence that is reflected regardless of gender within this particular cabinet.
The opposition, although they complained about the election, but they took part in the parliament. What do you make of that?
Well, we were all actually quite surprised because initially they came out and said, okay, they are looking at this election to having a new election, and therefore this election is invalid and null and void and actually a sham. And one would have then expected them to actually say, okay, we won't participate in any of the structures of government. But clearly, there is some political expediency where at the end of the day, people have expectations, and we heard them now saying that, no, we must protect what we have, which is really sad because at the end of the day, it kind of postpones the fundamental issue that if the election was invalid, then why participate in its results? So it's more of a political move than a logical one.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're most welcome.
Vince Musewe is a Zimbabwean economist. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. In Zimbabwe, the opposition says its members are being abducted, tortured, and left for dead as punishment for their political choices. From Harare, Rutendo Manwere has the story.
Two members of the opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, CCC, are in hospital. The two, Councillor-elect for Ward 27 in Glenora Harare, Wombera Ishenende, and Sanele Mukuhlani, were allegedly abducted Saturday from Harare, tortured, drugged, and then dumped in Mapinga, Mashonaland West Province. Another member of the same party on August 26, Nelson Mukwena, was also snatched from his home in Highfield, Harare by unidentified men, only to be found tortured in Mapinga after 2 days. Mukwena had helped apprehend what the police spokesperson later identified as the members of the Criminal Investigations Department, who allegedly wanted to abduct party spokesperson Promise Mukwananzi. A survivor of abduction and torture, Justina Mukoko, says the crimes are used as punishment in Zimbabwe for perceived government opponents.
We need to do away with abductions and torture. It just removes that thing that makes us a people when we have some of our own who are treated in the manner that people are treated in when they are abducted and tortured. There is nothing that a Zimbabwean is afraid of other than abduction and torture. And I think this is something that we need to be leaving behind.
Mukoko was a director of the Zimbabwe Peace Project, ZPP, an organization that monitors and documents human rights violations. She was abducted on 3 December 2008 and held incommunicado until 23 December when she was left by her kidnappers at Matapi Police Station in Harare. Mukoko was then charged for recruiting or attempting to recruit people for the purposes of undergoing military training to overthrow the government. The Zimbabwe Supreme Court later ordered a permanent stay of criminal proceedings against Mukoko, saying her fundamental rights had been violated. In 2018, the High Court of Zimbabwe ordered the state to pay compensation to Justina Mukoko of $150,000 for the abduction. She says those who are suspected of committing a crime should be arrested and not abducted.
If someone has committed a crime, let them go through the system within the police institution so that they can be protected by the law. The challenge with people being abducted and tortured is that they are away from being protected by the law. And that is actually against our constitution. We need to guarantee personal security and also human dignity.
Mukoko, who is now leaving ZPP, says survivors of abduction and torture need healing, which is why she's now forming a foundation.
Telling my story has contributed to my healing, and I believe that giving people an opportunity to tell their story will also contribute to their healing and restoration.
Police spokesperson Assistant Commissioner Paul Nyati told VOA that they are investigating the alleged abduction cases. Human rights activists say enforced disappearances are being used as a political tool against them and to silence political opponents. Reporting for VOA Africa, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 12th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Malawi's president has launched a large-scale crop production initiative known as Mega Farms, aimed at boosting the country's agricultural-based economy and help end persistent food shortages. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi has long faced food shortages at both national and domestic levels each year. This despite various efforts to boost agricultural production, including the targeted inputs program in which farmers buy seeds and fertilizer at cheaper prices. According to a report last month from the Famine Early Warning Systems Network, 4.4 million Malawians, representing 22% of the country's population, are facing food shortages, and the situation is expected to worsen from October to March 2024. Speaking during the televised launch of a mega farm in northern Malawi over the weekend, President Lazarus Chakwera said the program aimed to improve the country's foreign exchange reserves and make the country food sufficient.
This approach is also a game changer for our economy as a whole because most of our forex revenue comes from farming. But given the forex challenges we have faced in the recent past, as a consequence of the enormous debt left behind by past administrations, it is clear that our long-term solution has to involve boosting agricultural productivity for exports.
Minister of Trade and Industry, Simplex Chichura Banda, said the ministry has already found markets for produce from the mega farms. He said in June of this year, the Malawi government agreed with a foreign bank to build industrial parks in the capital, Lilongwe. and also the commercial capital, Blantyre.
The aim of these industrial parks is to engage into agro-processing and value addition. What it means, therefore, is that the mega farms have already markets to offtake their produce, and this will spell the boom of economic growth in this country.
Executive Director for the Farmers Union of Malawi, Jacob Nyilongo, says he hopes the mega farm program will help solve challenges facing small-scale farmers like access to markets.
Mega farms can become anchor farms and integrate small-scale farmers in their business model. So through that integration, small-scale farmers can have access to advisory service, they can have access to credit, but also they can have access to a market.
William Chanza is executive director for an independent agricultural policy think tank in Malawi, known by the acronym MAPATA, Malawi Agricultural Policy Advancement and Transformation Agenda. He told VOA that authorities should make more room for private investors to make the mega farm model sustainable.
And also make sure that we address some of the policy barriers to private sector engagement in agriculture, especially market and export-related issues, so that when they invest and produce, they're able to take the commodities on the export market.
President Chakwera said 800 medium and large-scale farmers have so far registered to grow crops in over 63,000 hectares of land to be cultivated during this year's growing season. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
In Tanzania, the main opposition party, Chadema, says its presidential candidate, Tundu Lissu, has been questioned by the police over plans to support the Maasai ethnic group who are being evicted from their ancestral homeland. Lissu is a former lawmaker and president of the Tanganyika Law Society. He was detained by the police over the weekend for holding an unlawful assembly and preventing the police from doing their jobs. Chadema denies the charges, saying they are politically motivated. John Mrema is Chadema's director of protocol, communications, and foreign affairs. He tells viewers Peter Clotty the opposition party is calling on the Maasai people to resist all attempts by the government to evict them from their ancestral home.
On Saturday, Tundu Lissu was denied an access to go to Ngorongoro, where Maasai people have been evicted by the government, so that one investor from the UAE in the name of OBC could get more land for his hunting activities. And Lissu was blocked by the police, and he was denied access to go to Ngorongoro. And yesterday morning, his hotel in Karatu was surrounded by the police with heavy weapons. And then he was arrested. And we didn't know where did they took him to until when the police issued a statement after a lot of noise countrywide that they are having him in Arusha.
But some people are saying that perhaps his arrest was also that he was challenging a government policy or a government measure that could create jobs for people in Ngorongoro, trying to undermine the peace there.
It's among the issues, but the main critical one is that the Maasai people who have been living in Ngorongoro since before independence, they are now forced by the government to leave Ngorongoro, and they are sent to a Tanga region in the area called Msomera. But the Maasai people, they have refused to get out of Ngorongoro. The government have decided to cut all the social services in Ngorongoro, from water, schools, hospitals, roads. The schools, teachers are no longer there. Hospitals, they are no doctors. They have been denied all social services. So the Maasai people are saying that they are not going to leave Ngorongoro because that is their ancestors' land, and they are not going to leave. So the government is using police to evict them forcefully. And that's the main key reason why the police and the government didn't want to allow us to go into it, because they know for sure that we will expose it to the world, because these people have been suffering since last year.
But why wouldn't Chadema encourage them to engage the government to resolve their concerns rather than strictly oppose what the government is trying to do, as I understand, to help the people themselves, that it could even get employment with what is going on there.
The issue is not employment, Peter, because these people have been evicted. They are forced to leave Ngorongoro to a place in Tanga region called Msomera. So the issue is not employment. It is they are supposed to leave so that a company from United Arab Emirates in the name of OBC, they can expand their land because they are doing hunting tourism in that place. That's the main reason.
John Mrema is the Director of Protocol, Communications and Foreign Affairs for Tanzania's main opposition, Chadema Party. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. From ground zero in New York to Alaska, U.S. political and military leaders took part on Monday in ceremonies to remember one of the darkest days in American history 22 years ago when 19 members of Al-Qaeda hijacked four planes. Nearly 3,000 people died in the coordinated attacks on September 11, 2001. Details from VOA's Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman.
The last of the major ceremonies on the anniversary of the country's worst terrorist attack took place midday in Alaska, where President Joe Biden was making his way back home following his attendance at the G20 Leaders Summit in India and meetings with top officials in Vietnam.
These trips are an essential part of how we're going to ensure the United States is flanked by the broadest array of allies and partners who will stand with us and deter any threat to our security.
The president also told service members at the military base in Anchorage the terrorist threat to the United States from the group that attacked the country in 2001 has receded.
Our intelligence community has recently assessed in a declassified memo that Al-Qaeda threat from Afghanistan and Pakistan has reached a historic low.
Earlier in the day, ceremonies were held to remember those at the sites where the four hijacked planes crashed, in New York City, outside the Pentagon in Northern Virginia, and in rural Pennsylvania. Those addressing the crowds said the country's resolve 22 years ago amid sadness and anger demonstrated a deeper sense of duty to community and country. Steve Herman, VOA News.
Libyan officials said on Monday that at least 150 people were killed when freak floods hit eastern Libya after Storm Daniel swept the Mediterranean. Images filmed by residents of the Libyan disaster area showed massive mudslides, collapsed buildings, and entire neighborhoods submerged under muddy water. Speaking on Libyan network Al-Masar, Usama Hara, prime minister of the east-based government, reported that more than 2,000 dead and 1,000 missing in the city of Derma alone, but no medical sources or emergency services have confirmed such figures. Gabon's new ruler, General Brice Oligui Nguema, on Monday appointed former opposition leaders and stalwarts of the ousted regime to both houses of parliament. Oligui has promised to hand the country back to civilian rule with elections after a transitional period without setting a date. According to a military decree, the new Senate will be led by Paulette Misambo, one of Ali Bongo's leading rivals at the election and head of the National Union Party. And that's it for this Tuesday, September 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Martin, Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.
Around the clock, the Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news.
Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week.
For the 5-Minute VOA Newscast.
We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the globe.
Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world.
VOA, your trusted source for news and information.